Welcome to the Brown Bagger here on CFRO Co-op Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver. What the world needs now is a cheap, safe replacement for fossil fuels. I think you'd agree. Could a technology known as cold fusion solve the climate and energy crisis? Does this mysterious technique even exist? Why are government funding agencies so hostile to cold fusion? Hundreds of billions have been spent on hot fusion, reproducing the sun's energy on Earth, with no real result. Yet there's been very little research into even the possibility of low-energy nuclear reactions, LENR. There is no better guide to the possibilities and pitfalls of cold fusion than Stephen B. Krivit, editor and publisher of the New Energy Times. Stephen is an investigative reporter with no ties to business and no tolerance for scams. Krivit recently briefed the American Chemical Society, and his joint work, Low Energy Nuclear Reactions Sourcebook, will be published by Oxford University Press in the fall of 2008. Stephen's latest book is The Rebirth of Cold Fusion, Real Science, Real Hope, Real Energy. On September 8th, Krivit spoke here in Vancouver. His presentation was organized by the New Energy Movement Canada and recorded by Alex Smith. Here is your introduction to cold fusion.
Good evening, and I also want to thank the New Energy Movement Canada so much for the invitation to be here and for making this possible. So I understand you've come here to learn about cold fusion. Well, you've come to the right place. I'm going to dive quickly into some background information on science for you. So pull up a chair and pull out your thinking caps. Let's just take a little bit of review of some science and some nuclear energy basics. Now, I don't know if any of you are nuclear physicists. If you are, please bear with me. But I want to at least provide some basic background so that everyone has a foundation of understanding. You all know about fission. Fission is where we get the nuclear energy from today that is producing electricity. That is the only type of nuclear energy right now that is producing electricity. And it certainly has its advantages and disadvantages that I'm sure all of you know about. There's another type of nuclear process, and that's thermonuclear fusion, sometimes known as hot fusion. We'll talk a little bit more about this in detail. And then, as you know, the focus of tonight's talk is on the low-energy nuclear reaction research, which has been historically known as cold fusion. More basics. Fission. Just to remind you, most of you probably already know this, but just as a reminder, fission is where you have a larger atom, and through a process, it is split into smaller nuclei. This is fusion. The typo is wrong here. Thermonuclear fusion is what this slide is supposed to say. And in this picture, we are showing two small nuclei joining together, forming a larger nuclei. In this case, deuterium, which is a form of hydrogen, changing into or transforming into helium-3. Some more basics about energy. It's important to understand the lay of the land when we start talking about low-energy nuclear reactions, to understand how they fit, how this subject fits into the broad picture and spectrum of energy. You've got cost, location, and size. For whatever device that you're going to be getting your electrical energy from. Some green alternatives, as you know, wind turbines. On your left is a picture of perhaps the world's largest wind turbine. On the right is a picture of a very small example of an alternative source of energy. It's a micro hydro generating device. These have their advantages and disadvantages. Now, location, obviously, you can't put a wind turbine everywhere. You can't put a micro hydro system anywhere. Here's another view of some of the alternatives. Solar. On your left is a huge solar array. You see the orange circle there? There's three people within that circle. That'll give you an idea of the scale of this device. And on the right is a smaller scale application of solar energy, as you're familiar with. Those are solar photovoltaic cells on the top of that home. Now, a little bit of a different concept, energy density. How much energy can you pack into a specific volume of fuel? Now, the fuel on your left, that's not the young man, but what he's carrying, the can of gasoline there. This is a rough analogy. On the left, we've got a can of gasoline. On the right, supposedly a uranium pellet that would be used in a fission reactor. I don't think that's a real uranium pellet. Otherwise, I think the person would be wearing gloves. But the point is the comparison of how much energy potential per size unit can come out, comparing chemical energy to nuclear energy. The text here shows that that pellet of uranium has the potential, the equivalent of 3.5 barrels of oil, 17,000 cubic feet of natural gas, and about 1,700 pounds of coal. So that's why energy density is important, because, you know, hydrogen has been talked about a lot, but if you're going to use uncompressed hydrogen in your car, you're going to need a huge tanker to follow you to power the car. That's why hydrogen can only be a practical application for vehicles if you compress it. I'm going to go back to the previous slide for a moment. There's a subtitle of this slide. These are real applications. Left is chemical, the right is nuclear fission. These are real applications right now that are producing energy. Now, I'm going to start talking about fusion and Lehner. These are not real applications. This is science research. There's no practical devices out there yet, be it hot fusion, cold fusion, warm fusion, whatever. There are no practical devices yet. That's why this slide is subtitled Science Research. What you see, what I have represented here, are drops of water. If you'll permit me to just generalize here, this drop of water represents approximately the relationship between how much energy you can get per volume relative to some of the other energy sources I just displayed on the previous screen. Yes, a drop of water has a potential energy, thousands of pounds of coal, thousands of cubic feet of natural gas. It gets back to what Einstein talked about, E equals MC squared. So much energy just in a tiny molecule. If mankind can only figure out how to release it. The mystery that many people have been trying to solve. So comparing what you have on the left side of the screen and the right side of the screen, both thermonuclear fusion, which some of you know about, the large hot fusion reactor that's maybe soon will start to be constructed in the south of France. They finally decided where to put it, but that reactor will use water as a fuel. And cold fusion, as it was historically known, and Lehner, as I call it now, does look like it also will use water or the hydrogen or deuterium that is taken out of the water molecules. Applications. Okay, again, real applications. On your left, internal combustion engine using chemical fuel. On your right, thanks to the Simpsons, we all know the size and the scale of nuclear power plants. Science research. This is thermonuclear fusion research. This is that big reactor that they're talking about building in the south of France. This is a schematic of it. If you like Rube Goldberg stuff, you love this. It's a bit complicated. I don't know if they'll ever figure it out. They've been working on it for 57 years. They are hoping that they might have a practical solution that results from this in another 50 years. Okay, scale. There's another orange circle on the slide there. Inside that circle is a human being. That's how big this thing is. Okay, see that orange circle? Now we're talking about a Lehner device or experiment. This is I don't know if any of you know John Dash from Portland State University. He's on the left there. This was a live demonstration that he and some high school students and college students showed at an international conference in Cambridge, Massachusetts in 2003. The scale difference, as you can see here, is incredibly different. And it may turn out that this small scale, the ability for Leonard to scale in small and medium-sized applications could be very dynamic. The larger device, this one here, the ITER, the International Thermonuclear Experimental Reactor. Let's see, the price tag I think is $20 billion, maybe a little more. They keep increasing it, so I'm having a tough time remembering what the price right now. So yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what plays out with this hot fusion thing. I don't know. I could bet, but I wouldn't bet for it. So generalizing again, concepts. Two types of energy forms that we're dealing with in the world, in the industrialized world here. Liquid fuels and electricity. Liquid fuels, petroleum, ethanol, primary application that we use it for is for transportation. The reasons? Because it's dense. Remember the picture of the boy with the gasoline can? You got a lot of energy in a small container. It's portable, like the young man showed us. And it's independent. Independent. Well, that means it does not need to be tied to the earth, to a particular place where the wind blows, does not need to be tied to a particular place where the river flows. I didn't mean for that to be rhyming, but I guess it did. So the liquid fuels are, there are not many good options right now for replacement of the liquid fuels. And that's a significant concern. I don't know if anyone has any answers to that yet. But we're going to talk about the electrical generation applications a little bit more. On your left, a few methods for the electrical generation. Hydro, wind, tidal. And you've got nuclear, chemical, and solar. These four groups are the main groups where electrical energy is generated. We're going to focus a little bit more closely now on nuclear and chemical. What both of these forms of energy do are they create heat. Nuclear reaction creates heat through the nuclear fission process. Chemical reaction burns something. You get heat. The heat boils water. Water creates steam. Steam turns a turbine. You get electricity. You can plug in your toaster. Hydro, wind, tidal. They skip all the middle part, they go right to a turbine, create your electricity for you. Over on the right-hand side, solar can go right to a photovoltaic cell, you get your electricity. Now, focusing in more closely to the nuclear area. Nuclear energy creates heat. Now I'm going to get to tie how this relates to low-energy nuclear reactions. 1989, these two gentlemen, Martin Fleischmann on your left, Stanley Pons on your right, they said they did what no one else for 30 years had been able to do prior to them. They said they had attained a sustained nuclear fusion reaction. They said they were able to do this with just $100,000 versus, a few billion dollars. Well, the reaction was quite interesting. There was a lot of excitement because obviously it was assumed that it was just a possibly new source of energy. Where did the energy come from? Why did they think it was energy? Because it was creating heat. This little cell was creating too much heat, more heat than they could explain by any conventional chemistry explanation. They were putting in a few milliwatts. They were saying they got 4 watts out. Turns out they didn't exactly get 4 watts, but that's what they reported. That's what started this excitement and this interest. That was exciting. On the cover of three of the most prominent U.S. news magazines, all in the same week. Initially, people were pretty happy about it. They were excited. They thought this was definitely going to be the answer. Why? Producing energy from water. The water is basically virtually unlimited. If you're tapping the water that's available, let me speak more precisely. The deuterium, which is a form of hydrogen, if you're using that, which comes from water in the ocean, you can probably run tens of thousands of years and not make a dent in the amount of water that you pull out of the ocean to power the entire world. So that's why it's considered virtually unlimited. As they saw, there didn't appear to be any dangerous radiation, and there was not apparently any harmful radioactive waste left over after the experiments. I want to confirm to you that these initial expectations, these initial observations, still hold true today. After almost 20 years, it still seems very clear that there was something producing more heat here than can be explained. It still looks like deuterium and hydrogen are the fuel, and it still looks like it's clean. So the Fleischmann and Pons said they got this in this little reactor, and then compared to, this is what the outside of a hot fusion reactor looks like. This is it. So you compare these little test tubes they've got in their hands with this, and you can start to understand why there was quite a bit of surprise. I understand they just decommissioned this reactor at Princeton. They gave up on it a few years ago. They said it was a good learning experience. This is what the inside of it looks like. Again, for scale, there's our orange circle with a human being inside of it. So $20 billion now, 57 years, and counting. I'm in touch with people in the U.S. and France who are working on the hot fusion project. There must be several dozen hot fusion reactors around the world. And as I understand, among those reactors, which at one point people thought they might eventually see a positive generation of energy, they've all given up. And they said, these devices that we've made so far, they're never going to do it. We need a bigger one. They're probably going to get it. We'll see. And then you've got the little test tubes. But then that's where the problems started happening with these cold fusion cells. People had a lot of trouble replicating it. They got angry. They got frustrated. And they started going on the attack. What happened to Fleischmann and Pons? They retreated. And they were also, along with the University of Utah, trying to maximize the economic potential for themselves. And so they were not saints. They did not hand over their secrets to the rest of the scientific world. This earned them no favor, and it fueled the controversy. So it didn't work out too well for them. That's what people started saying. Fraud, delusion, incompetence. They said it was all a mistake. But I've investigated almost all of the people who made these accusations. And in every single case, I found that their accusations were baseless. They were opinions, not facts. Yeah, they had a right to be angry. That's true. It was very frustrating for them. That's true. But they were not correct to say that it was fraud or a mistake. They didn't. These critics, these people who did the unscientific criticism, they may have known about certain aspects of nuclear physics, but they did not know what Fleischmann and Pons were doing. They did not have the skill and expertise that Fleischmann and Pons had. So they said it was the scientific fiasco of the century. They said it was voodoo science, bad science. Yeah, Bob Park wrote a book called Voodoo Science. And he didn't seem to really know too much about the subject. And my review of his treatment of cold fusion will be published in the Journal of Scientific Exploration this month. So how did this happen, and who were the leaders? Nathan Lewis of Caltech stood in front of the world's media and said, "We couldn't find anything. We looked here, we looked there, we looked everywhere. We couldn't find any evidence. That must mean. He didn't say it in these words, but his implication was, that must mean it's not real, that it doesn't exist. His associate, Stephen Coonan, who was at Caltech and now is the chief scientist for British Petroleum, accused Fleischmann Pons of incompetence and delusions. And these might sound like rather unprofessional comments and rather bold statements to make. I listened to an interview, an audio interview, at the Cornell Archive Library a few weeks ago. Coonan actually admitted to a reporter that he premeditated these words. He thought about them carefully, and he reviewed them with some of his colleagues, if you can believe that, before saying this in front of the world's media. That was this is May 1st, May 2nd, 1989, at the American Physical Society meeting in Baltimore, Maryland. Right around the same time, gentleman who was leading the hot fusion program at MIT, he pretty much joined the crowd and said to a reporter, "It's fraud." So this pretty much set the wheels in motion for the excommunication of Fleischmann and Pons and the disparagement of this entire subject. It's taken quite a while to redevelop the understanding of the subject and the recognition that it is valid science. Now, some of the critics and skeptics did have some legitimate science questions. They said, "It doesn't look like fusion." They were right. To borrow the line from Star Trek, it's not fusion as we currently know it. They said, "Where's the neutrons?" You know, some guy at MIT called up someone in D.C. and said, "Hey, where's the neutrons? If this is fusion, there should be 10 to the 15th number of neutrons per second coming out, and these guys should have been dead if they saw 4 watts of heat." You'll hear me talk a little bit later. Yes, they have found some evidence of neutrons, but nowhere near the number the rate of neutrons that would come out if it was a conventional fusion reaction. So to sum up why it was so controversial, yeah, it didn't look like thermonuclear fusion. It appeared to contradict the laws of physics, because people were wondering, well, what happened to E equals MC squared? If you're getting energy, what is being transformed from mass to energy? They didn't know what was being what the ingredients were, the inputs. They didn't know what the outputs were. Well, it took a few years. It's become quite clear. The inputs are deuterium and hydrogen. The outputs are primarily helium-4. This announcement in 1989 was extremely threatening to the thermonuclear fusion groups. They were already in the process of having their funding cut. They were about to have another round of applications for their funds. And then this stuff comes out saying, "Hey, we can do it in a test tube. We don't need $1 billion. They didn't take too friendly to the idea. Also, there's this attitude that we know everything there is to know about science. Unbelievable as it may sound to a group of people like you, yes, this was a lot of the attitude. There was even a book, I believe, called End of Science. Mind-boggling, if you ask my opinion. A problem in the early days of this research, and it still is a problem now, is it's a very difficult science problem. It's not like high-temperature superconductivity where within weeks people were able to easily replicate it around the world. No, this one is not that easy. So what happened? 6 months after the announcement, well, the Department of Energy didn't help. In November 1989, they came out with a report. They supposedly looked at the research, and they looked at the papers, and they said, well, it's not real. Nothing to see. Move along. And we're not going to fund it. But why don't you go try to, why don't you research your coal fusion research? Why don't you go just try to polish your act up a little bit and come back to us? Well, how'd that happen? Because the President of the United States on April 14th was told it wasn't real. Somebody told him. No, he knew. Without doing any investigations, someone told him, we know it's not real. All you need to do to get rid of this problem is have the Department of Energy perform an investigation, and they'll tell you it's not real. And, you know, you'll be done with it. That was Glenn Seaborg. He was an advisor to numerous presidents of the United States. Am I making this up? No. Seaborg was proud of this. I learned about this from a videotape where he was speaking at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, proud of his service with, I think, over 10 presidents of the United States. And he helped George Bush. Yeah, he helped George Bush take care of cold fusion. Yeah. We'll remember him. Now, we'll jump forward in time. The Department of Energy took a second look at, well, they called it low-energy nuclear reactions in 2004. I called it a cold fusion review. Other people in the media called it a cold fusion review. But I look back at it recently, it wasn't a review. And it wasn't done well. The DOE didn't want it. There were several researchers within the field who pushed it on DOE. And they didn't present a broad picture of the entire field. They presented their particular aspect of the research. So it really didn't serve the community in a broad way. The Department of Energy, they didn't bite. They found that they could get away with saying, well, we're not convinced. We're going to wait until you get better results. That's what they did. Now, the upside of what happened, however, was that people around the world noticed, hey, the Department of Energy is taking a second look. And just by virtue of the fact that they took a second look at what was supposedly dead and gone, sparked worldwide interest. You're not seeing it in the newspapers. You're not reading it, hearing about it on television. But it's happening. Since 2004, I've heard of numerous people, businessmen, industry. They're quiet about it, but there's been money coming into the field. The researchers who were formerly retired, many of them in their 70s. They are no longer retired. I know some of them who have multiple contracts with private groups right now. In fact, I'd be hard-pressed to think of any of these formerly retired researchers who are now unemployed. It's rather remarkable. These people, many of them in their 70s now, going back to work because people are realizing there's some real stuff here. I'm going to jump back in time now because you're going to be wondering, well, what happened? How did it get from not real to real? How did it get from where it wasn't working to where it is working, or at least recognition of a real effect? There were people in 1989 who found out how to get the reactions to show real evidence of a low-energy nuclear reaction. You know, I've been using that term now for a few minutes. Let me help perhaps clarify it. Low-energy nuclear reaction. It means that you have an experiment, a process, that is producing some nuclear energy, some nuclear effects. It does not necessarily mean it is producing low amounts of energy, but it means that it's happening in a room temperature environment, in a more or less normal laboratory. This is in contrast to high energy physics, where you need something the size of a 10-story container, and you need temperatures in the millions of degrees to create a nuclear reaction. So that's the derivation of the term low-energy nuclear reactions.
You are listening to a speech by Stephen B. Krivet, editor of the online magazine New Energy Times. The topic is cold fusion, also known as low-energy nuclear reactions, LENR. This presentation in Vancouver, Canada, on September 8, 2008, was presented by the New Energy Movement Canada.
Tadahiko Mizuno from Hokkaido University was one of the people who saw positive results early on. But unlike Lewis, Kunin, other people, they just tried for 40 days. And they gave up after 40 days. This guy, as you'll see, as others, spent 8 months preparing before he did his very first experiment. That's the type of work and background that you needed these days, in those days, to start this research and do it seriously. The people who supposedly debunked it, they didn't do it seriously. They tried, gave it a quick shot, it doesn't work. And they told the rest of the world. Edmund Storms, while he was at Los Alamos National Laboratory, he also succeeded. Why? He got lucky. There was a particular type of palladium that worked better than the others. He had that palladium. He also took the time to learn new skills. In order to accurately measure the heat that is produced from these reactions, you have to know electrochemistry. You have to know calorimetry. He didn't, but he took the time to learn it. He says he also attributed his success to luck, too. Michael McCubre from SRI International. He already had 4 people on his team that had experience with palladium and deuterium, that had been working on it for many years. They spent 3 months preparing and planning their first experiment, and they spent 2 months running it. Bob Huggins from Stanford, they have background in it. He also had a unique kind of palladium that had some lithium in it. And it may turn out, I do not know yet, and I do not know if the field knows, but it may turn out that lithium is a key factor to getting these experiments to produce energy. Melvin Miles, when he was with the China Lake United States Navy, he too had access to... Now, there's a funny story here. So he succeeded because he had the particular palladium that had the right mixture of whatever it is. I don't know what the particular alloy or the composition of this Johnson-Matthey palladium was, but it was well known in the early days that this was the one that worked. And Miles did a study one time. He compared different manufacturers of palladium, and it showed that the Johnson-Matthey was at like 80% level. Other manufacturers were down 10%, zero. Miles was one of the researchers who failed in the first 6 months. His failed experiments were included in the Department of Energy review, the one that was published in November 89. And that was used as evidence that told to us that cold fusion didn't work. Well, guess what happened in month 7? Yeah, that's when he started using the Johnson-Matthey palladium, but that was a month too late for the Department of Energy review. But he didn't care what the Department of Energy said. This is a key factor of what happened. He didn't care what other people said. He knew what he saw. He trusted his experiments. He trusted his equipment. This is a very key factor in what's happened in this research. The people who have stuck with this did so because they knew what they were doing with their basic instrumentation, with their basic skills in these related subject matters, and they had the confidence to see, well, that looks like a positive signal, I'm going to go with it. The heck with what the people are saying in the newspapers, I'm going to go with it. And that had a lot to do with how this field has gotten to where it is today. We're about 20 years out now. And I have spoken in front of numerous science audiences, and I have been asked many, many questions from many skeptical people. And although I don't memorize the skeptical questions and the answers to them, I have investigated them, researched them, and reported them. And from my work, I believe that all of the legitimate skeptical questions have been answered. So now we'll get into a little bit about what is known. Repeating a little bit of what we said earlier, what goes into the experiments? Hydrogen, or its brother deuterium, which has an extra neutron in its nucleus. Metal. The palladium group metals, and nickel, titanium. As I mentioned, also lithium does appear to be an important component, though there are some people, some of the researchers in the field don't all agree with this, but this is my perspective at the moment. And there are no experiments right now that are self-sustaining. They need input. And the input comes either from a few watts or milliwatts of electrical energy. There are a whole another group. There are actually about 10 different methods to run these experiments. Electrochemistry is just one of them. Some of these experiments are mechanical. There is no electrochemistry. There is no electrical input. There is deuterium gas. It is forced through a membrane, pulled by a vacuum on the other side. Coming out, the main product that comes out, and the most important one so far, is energy. As I said, in the form of heat. Secondarily, the nuclear product that comes from the deuterium is helium. In this case, helium-4, for those of you who are scientists, helium-4 seems to be the dominant product rather than helium-3. Though helium-3 is also seen sometimes, to a lesser extent, a variety of other effects and other products are also seen. Elements have been reported that have been transmuted from one to the other. Now, of course, deuterium into helium is a transmutation. When I say transmutation, I'm often referring to heavier elements like strontium or cesium. Tritium comes out very rarely, but when it does, it has been reported at significant levels above background. Neutrons, not the kind of neutrons that'll kill you, but neutrons have been detected most recently by a Navy group in San Diego. And there's other weird stuff too. Oh, we've got to go back. See, I got my little picture of the where's the bun? No, where's the beef? Where's the beef? Yeah, that's supposed to be your reminder that the small neutrons. So excess heat, just as a refresher, why this is a very important concept. This is a scientific term that it's referred to. You're getting more heat out than should come out if you take into account all of the known inputs and materials in the experiment. What doesn't come out, okay, this is important too. Helium is not a greenhouse gas, and it doesn't produce, as is known so far, any greenhouse gases. It's not producing any strong prompt radiation or radioactive waste. Now, the tritium is radioactive, but its half-life is 12 years, and when it decays, it turns into helium. So it's not a huge problem from my perspective. Here's a little look at some of the apparatus. This is Pamela Boss from the San Diego Navy Group. It's a 1989-era cold fusion cell. Here's a close-up of it. A lot of custom glasswork there. The experiments of the configurations have gotten much simpler. They've actually refined the process by which this particular in which this particular cell developed. They've refined this into a small acrylic square acrylic box. That's it. I'll see if I have pictures for her later. All right, Carissa Lee. Carissa Lee, she was a high school, I believe, at Gresham High School. She was working with John Dash. Those are two cells. One is the test cell, the other is the control cell. Close-up of it. Looks simple. To a certain extent, it is. Probably you could get these materials set up for, well, the most expensive part here is the palladium. Maybe $1,000 for a kit here. But don't be fooled. It's not as simple as it looks. Not at all. A lot of people thought, hey, this is really simple. You just put two electrodes in a jar of salt water. No way. And I'm not going to get deep into the scientific reasons, though. If you want, after the questions, during the questions and answers, I can get into it. But the conditions required to get the excess heat reaction are not easy at all. The material preparation to prepare the metals, that is another aspect that is extremely difficult. And to know that you're actually getting excess heat and not an illusion or a fantasy, you have to be very good at your instrumentation. Here's another related device. This one is, it's pushing a hydraulic fluid through a small orifice. I'm not sure exactly where this fits into the whole Leonard ball game, but I just like this one because it looks cool. I saw, by the way, I did see an experiment very similar to this one, Edmonton. I was in Edmonton in 2005, and they had one of these running. I saw it running live. The glow wasn't quite as bright and luminescent as this one, but I did see it. It was interesting, but the researchers have since more or less gone underground, and they haven't been willing to share with me as a reporter the key evidence to support their work. I wish them luck, but I also wish they would tell the rest of us what's going on. So let's take a broader view. What does all this mean? What are we doing with it? What's the problem? How come it's not available to us right now? What's in the way? The stigma is still a very big problem. There are papers that are being published, but not many. It's still very challenging to get papers, scientific papers, accepted. I've seen communications where journal editors won't even send the papers out for review. The responses are, dear researcher, thank you for submitting your paper on palladium deuterium. We don't think our readers would be interested in this topic. We suggest you find a more specialized journal. They don't think people would be interested. I don't know. I think people would be interested. I think the journals are afraid. That's what I think. So funding is still a significant challenge, and there are some isolated instances of government funding, but because of the stigma, most government program managers are quite reluctant to put their butt on the line and fund this and endorse it. It's not a politically easy thing to do. Because of that reason and because of the interest that's generated, as you'll see, I'm starting to see that this research is probably going to be carried and led by the commercial sector rather than the government sector. So there's more of a thirst and a desire for innovation and profit from the commercial sector. They're much more willing, from what I've seen so far, to take chances. So the second thing here, what's the problem? There's a disbelief that is not a nuclear phenomenon, that is not nuclear energy. This is an important disbelief because the people think, well, if it's just another form of chemical energy, then, you know, it's not going to be the major change that people are looking for. It's not going to be worthwhile investing millions of dollars into it. But it's quite clear to me, of course, it is nuclear. This is beyond question in my mind. There's another problem. The belief that it's fusion. You know, I know, you're looking at me, you know I'm the guy who wrote the book, The Rebirth of Cold Fusion. That was 5 years ago. I don't know whether the actual process is fusion. I'm starting to think that it's probably not fusion, but it's some other new type of unrecognized nuclear process. For the nuclear physicists among you, it's looking like it may be a weak interaction, neutron-catalyzed process, and not necessarily your 10 to the minus 13th less reaction rate than you get from fusion. There are researchers who have done some first principles rates calculations in these environments that suggest that yes, even though it may be, the basis for it may be weak interactions, that there are circumstances where you can start to see MeV level of energy. And those theoretical explanations match the experimental research that has shown that there is energy here that is at least 1,000 times larger than what you can expect and explain from chemistry. What's the problem with the experiments? Nature is being very stubborn. She is not revealing the secrets very easily. They're learning things. 20 years now, they've learned many things about the field. There are still many other things that they don't know, like how to turn it on, how to turn it off, or how to turn it up, how to turn it down, exactly what's the right mix of ingredients, materials. The researchers don't have all the answers to these questions yet. They haven't been well funded. They've been doing the best they can on a shoestring. And in the last 2 years, another factor has come into play that has, I think, interfered, but it's natural, it's to be expected. The money is starting to come in. Researchers are starting to get competitive. Start to pull back from what they're sharing with each other. And they're starting to get a little bit aggressive. We'll see how this all plays out. So, uncertainties. These are the questions that I have. I don't have answers for. Please don't ask me. I already tell you, this is what I don't know. When will it be practical? Will it scale? Will it be useful on an integrated circuit? Will it be useful for a washing machine? This is a big question. And if so, at what cost? Like, for example, solar is a great option for electrical generation, but it still costs more than coal. So Leonard could work fine, but if it's 3 or 4 times more than coal-produced electricity, I don't know if the majority of the people in this room would end up using it. So it has to be cost-effective. Will it replace liquid fuels? I'm actually, you know, if the other answers turn out to be yes answers, I'm optimistic it will, because we have, at least experimentally, a system which can be small, portable, self-contained, energy is dense. So that's why we talked about those other things in the beginning of the presentation. Big concern. Will this knowledge die? It's a sad but real consideration that many of these researchers have. The researchers in the field who have the greatest expertise right now do so because in the beginning, 1989, throughout most of this time period, the only people who had the safe ability to do this forbidden research were people who were retired. So they're getting up there in age. And last question, will it be used for destruction? You know, I know it's not a question which anybody likes to consider, but I'm a realist. And from what I know, any time that humankind or has discovered a source of energy. It has been able to use that for destructive purposes as well as constructive purposes. And I hope that today, tomorrow, in the future, that far-sighted people who are responsible for societal decisions start paying attention to this and can help set a good groundwork for the peaceful uses of this potential technology. So what's going to happen now? Who's going to get the answers to these questions and who's going to make it work? Well, I think you will. Those of you who might be associated with universities or know people in universities, universities are great avenues for doing this research. You really need a wide variety of tools and resources to do this work properly. And also, the commercial enterprise, I think, is very, very much going to take a strong lead in bringing this forward. They've got the incentive. Every time a barrel of oil goes up a dollar, more incentive for Lenner, solar, all the other alternatives. So I'll take your questions in a moment, but as you go forward in learning more about the subject, if you talk to other people, you have further questions, I'd be very happy to answer your questions over email in the future. Please let me know what happens when you talk to other people about this. What questions come up, what controversies might arise. I'd be very happy to continue a dialogue with you, and I'd be very interested to hear what happens or what doesn't happen.
That was Stephen B. Krivet, editor of the online magazine New Energy Times at newenergytimes.com. The topic was cold fusion, also known as low-energy nuclear reactions, LENR. The presentation was September 8, 2008, at the downtown campus of Simon Fraser University, recorded by Alex Smith. Hosts were the New Energy Movement Canada at newenergymovement.ca. You can also find out more at newenergymovement.org. The volunteer organization is dedicated to finding sources of new clean energy to help the environment and the world. On October 9th at the Vancouver Public Library, group members Jean Manning and Joel Garbin will introduce their new book, Breakthrough Power. Remember, if you want to know more about cold fusion, contact journalist Stephen B. Krivet at newenergytimes.com. For those just tuning in, this is Alex Smith. I'm in the auditorium with Steve Krivet after a great lecture. He's the editor and publisher of New Energy Times. Steve, how did you get hooked on this fusion energy?
Fusion or whatever it is. You know, I wish I knew the answer to that question. All I can tell you is that I saw a video one day that was produced and promoted by Gene Malov called Cold Fusion, Fire from Water. Fire from Water. And I said, what the heck? I thought the whole thing had been buried, and I was just amazed that it was still alive and kicking. So I contacted Malov and went to his lab, and that's how it started.
And the rest is history. How long has New Energy Times been going?
Started, must have been shortly after that. I forget the exact date, but what happened was after I visited Malov for the first time, I realized there was something there. And I set out to learn what I could about it, and I realized that when I started searching on the web that there's this huge polarity on the subject. There's people that said it was real, there's people that said it wasn't real. So I figured, well, how the heck could this be? How could it be both different places at the same time? And I started doing a website, and when I learned things from researchers and scientists, I put it up on the website, so soon after 2000.
And could you tell us what would be, some of my audience are real environmentalists, what would be the implications for the environment of this possible new energy source?
It produces heat, which can be turned into electricity, which can be used directly for heating. The byproduct is helium. You know, helium is basically harmless. You can even inhale it and make your voice sound funny, too. 20 years now,
20 years of research, and still it looks like there are no greenhouse gases, no harmful radiation, and no long-lived radioactive waste. That part of it is still miraculous and still appears to be valid.
And why are groups like the American Chemical Society taking another look at LENR energy?
Well, in my opinion, it's inevitable because the science is valid. And it's taken a while for the scientists who have been researching this for 19, 20 years, it's taken a while for them to collect the evidence to answer the questions that needed to be answered. They've obtained the answers. They've published the answers. So they, like other people around the world, have started reading and realizing, you know, there's very strong evidence here for something. We don't know whether it's fusion, fission, or whatever, or some other type of process, but there's something here. It looks like it's producing energy, and it looks like it could be very important.
I know that you have kept your focus pretty cleanly on the possible use of this energy and investigating the science, but am I right in thinking sometime you could probably also write a memoir about some of the dark sides of the pursuit of this kind of energy?
Oh, yeah. I've been in some interesting situations, which I hope to have the opportunity to write memoirs about.
There's probably some people afraid to hear you say that. Okay, and what's coming up for you? What are the hot topics?
The American Chemical Society has asked us to write another book. We edited a source book on LENR that was published, just came out a couple of weeks ago, published by Oxford University Press. So it's quite nice to have these type of publishing companies and science organizations starting to recognize the legitimacy of the field and to start paying attention to it, which I think is quite an appropriate thing to do. So we've got that book in the works. Also, they're going to host another session next March in Salt Lake City, and there'll be at least a day, possibly several days worth of the latest scientific research presented in Salt Lake.
Well, this is Alex Smith reporting with Steve Krivet, the editor of NewEnergyTimes.com. Thank you very much, Steve.
Thank you, Alex.
Thanks for tuning in to the local Brown Bagger every Tuesday at 12 noon here on CFRO, Co-op Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver, Canada. We'll go out with Canadian recording artist Mae Moore, Red Clay Hills.